studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning we speak first with Diana McLean Smith, who consults globally on how to build relationships strong enough to master the toughest challenges. She'll discuss how to unite the divide in our polarized world by remaking the space between us, which is the title of her new book.
Then Julia Geyser of the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance and Cindy Grant of Inspired Summit Adventures talk about the upcoming climbing event of the year. It's the Salt Lake Climbing Festival, fundraising event coming up on August 24th and 25th, produced by the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance. These guests when we return. You're listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Over the last three decades or so, our next guest, Diana McLean Smith, has studied and advised leaders and their teams on how to build relationships strong enough to master their toughest challenges. And what challenge could be tougher than uniting our country? Of helping us see each other as humans instead of adversaries or allies. Diana brings her unique expertise to our current social and political rift in her new book, Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. She offers tools and insights to help people better relate to those on the opposite side of their political spectrum. And she joins us this morning to discuss and offer up some of these solutions. Diana McLean Smith, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Well, thank you for having me. Utah is one of my favorite places on the planet, so it's lovely to be here.
Well, you know, we're so glad that you could join us. And I was just thinking this morning, many of our guests say, oh, the mountain life, that sounds so great. Oh, I love the mountain life.
Right.
But then I thought, you know, even here in our little idyllic mountain town, there are people, it's the e-bikers against the,
yes, of course,
against the non-e-bikers, the conflicts on the trails. And you think, this is the biggest question of our time right now. How do we even begin to tackle it? How have you done this in your book?
Well, I was going to start where I usually start, which is to give a little background on the book. But now that you're talking about the mountain life, can I tell you a little story about how I got started on this journey?
Sure.
Because it took place in Billings, Montana, which is the mountain life, right? Mm-hmm. And it was in the early 1990s. I wasn't doing it in the 1990s, but I uncovered a story about Billings in 1993, around that era. You know, Billings was doing well economically. It was a vibrant center. It was there in the middle of heaven, gorgeous country. There were a series of hate crimes that occurred. A Native American home was vandalized and they put a SWAT sticker on the outside of the house. And then a African-American church was intimidated by skinheads who came and tried to scare the congregants. And then a young six-year-old boy put a menorah in his window at Hanukkah and somebody threw a brick through the window. So a woman by the name of Patrice O'Neill, who ended up starting a nationwide movement called Not in Our Town, decided to film how the community responded to it. First, the painters union came and repainted the house for free. Then white neighbors came and joined their congregants at the African-American church. And then the local paper published a picture of a menorah and people, hundreds of people put it in their windows. Mm. And that was the beginning of my journey. It was the beginning of Patrice O'Neill's journey because she took her film of how the community responded. The painter who painted the house said, don't they do that elsewhere? I mean, we wanted to send a message to these guys, not in our town. So she brought the film to the Bay Area where she's from and she showed it to the communities there. And she said, what do you think of these folks in Billings? And they went, we don't want to talk about Billings. We want to talk about our town. We want to talk about, are we creating towns strong enough to resist hate? Are we creating towns of belonging? Okay, and what are we doing? And that was the beginning of a nationwide movement around Not in Our Town, saying we've got, we the citizens have got to begin to build communities that are strong enough to combat extremism, to combat hate. And that was where my journey began. And so I want to say I was able to do a lot of research into how did we get here, which is the first part of the book. But the rest of the book is what hundreds of thousands of citizens are doing under the radar to begin to work across divides, demographic divides, ideological divides, on common problems in local communities, connecting what they're doing nationally. Hundreds of thousands. And you don't hear about it because the press leads with what bleeds, with a few notable exceptions like NPR and others. But, you know, the mainstream dominant press leads with what bleeds. And so we're not hearing about it. So I'm here to say there's lots of hope. There are lots of organizations out there. We can talk more about it on the show.
So I'm wondering, Diana, as you're talking along and hearing about this, you know, not in our town, it kind of gives me those good chills. You know, I feel like, oh, there's good in the world. But I wonder, is it going to looking at what foments hate or just look, you know, forgetting about that and looking at how we can resist hate or division or, you know,
I think that's very important. Yeah. I mean, when I started trying to understand how did we get here, the place I began was to look at something that is ubiquitous and it lies in plain sight, but it's so much the woof and warp of our lives, we don't see it. And that is how ever since our founding and long before actually, we have divided ourselves into groups that are divided across demographic and ideological lines. So we hang out with people like us, okay? And that is not necessarily a problem until circumstances start to pose threats and uncertainties and anxieties. And when that happens, like the pandemic, globalization, migration, all of those things start to raise people's fears. And when that occurs, people become more insular within their groups. The mental space of those groups gets smaller and smaller and smaller. They start circulating the same ideas, the same facts, looking at the same shows. The more insular people get within, the more distant they grow across, and the more fearful they go across. The more distant and fearful across, the more insular within. So today, when you're hearing how important it is that we bridge, people don't understand that before we bridge across, we need to open the space within our own groups. Otherwise, we're just going to sit and tell the other group they're wrong and why they're wrong and how stupid they are and how crazy they are. Until we start to look at our own assumptions, until we start to introduce new information into our own group, new ideas into our own group, we can't possibly reach across divides. So it starts with us and our own groups.
I want to dig into that a little bit. Yes. I feel like there is this hell in a handbasket feeling going on with a lot of people where they're just throwing up their hands. It's beyond saving. And I think that leads to such an atmosphere of inaction. And so much of what you're writing about in this book is fantastically active. It's about people making positive changes and choosing to be active instead of choosing to, you know, bury their head in the sand or just throw their hands up. Is there some kind of trait that you're noticing amongst the people who are joining these positive responses that we can foster in our communities?
It's a great question. And I have two thoughts, one of which speaks directly to what you're saying, but then I want to step back for a second because I think the fundamental problem is most people have gotten so exhausted and despairing, they don't have the energy to do this, okay? But let's for a moment talk about the people who do, okay? I think anytime a society goes through a societal change, you get early adopters, okay? People who lead the way. And they're very important because they create a toehold for the rest of us because they show us what's possible. They don't go all the way there. That's what a toehold is. It just gets you part of the way, okay? But they show us what's possible. And that's a hugely important step and an incredible service that those folks are doing. Now, there are hundreds of thousands of them, so it's not a small number. When I wrote the book, I thought it was tens of thousands, but then I kept doing research and I'm like, oh my God, I underestimated. I was worried I might've been overestimating. But so let me say a little bit about what you're getting at in the beginning, which is how discouraged people are. Again, you know, because of the nature of the press, and I'll tell you just a quick story to drive home the idea. Judy Woodruff, who you well know, did an interview with Roger Ailes back in the 1980s. And this is the beginning of the end in terms of the media, okay? He said, here's the thing. You get two candidates, you put them on a stage. One of them gives you the 3-point peace plan in the Middle East, and the other one falls in the orchestra pit. Who do you think the media is going to cover? Okay. All right. So extremists are constantly throwing themselves into the orchestra pit. All right. And so the media goes, that's a great story. You know, the woman who's raising her fist at a school board meeting and looking angry, right? It's the outrage model of journalism. So an organization by the name of More in Common, you may be familiar with their work. More in Common did an extraordinary service in 2018. They decided to find out just how extreme, how many people are really extreme, and where do people lie in this tribal reality of ours, okay? So they created this research project called Hidden Tribes of America. And they discovered six tribes, might be seven actually. But the big takeaway is 67% of people live in tribes that are different from one another, but they're pragmatic and they're flexible and they're open to learning and change. Something that James Fishkin and Larry Diamond at the Stanford Democracy Lab also went on to study and discovered that people are very open to changing within this group, okay? And probably outside of it, but Fishkin and Diamond don't go into that. But anyway, so 67%, very pragmatic, very flexible, open to learning. 33% are on the more ideological wings on the left and right. And the right has gotten quite large compared to the left. I think the left is like 12 or 13% and the 20% is the right. Those extreme wings, their voices are drowning out the 67%, in part because the 60% is letting them, because they're so damn tired and exhausted, pardon my language. Yeah. So one of the reasons I wrote the book is I want to say, we can't let them dominate the discourse, okay? We have to move and do things that will take back the ground. And there's a wonderful essay, it's an article in the Christian Science Monitor by a woman by the name of Courtney Martin. And I write an essay about it in the book called Helping from the Periphery, because the 67% have been pushed to the periphery. So how do you help from the periphery? And Courtney Martin gives a wonderful example of a town in Middletown in Ohio where faith leaders got together and said, we've got to help the school board. They're getting drowned out by these people who are showing up and screaming and yelling and dominating the mic. And they came to the meeting, they brought their congregants with them, and they stood up and they went to the mic and they said, look, we have doubts about some of the policies and we are shoulder to shoulder with the board. This is about the kids, okay? And we need to help the kids. And they completely ended the culture wars in Middletown, Ohio. And that is mobilizing the 67%. It's amazing. And all of these organizations are mobilizing the 67%. Yeah.
Yes. Let's actually, if you wouldn't mind, share a little bit of the examples of what happened in Billings and how did people respond to some of the extremist and hateful things that were going on there. I thought it was so inspiring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was an extraordinary story, but it's also only the first and the smallest of the stories I discovered. Okay. I mean, they did what they did. I mean, the white neighbors joined the African-American neighbors and said, not in our town. You know, they ought to be able to go to church unintimidated by skinheads. The people hung paper menorahs in their windows. They essentially said, not in our town. But you can find this everywhere. I mean, it is truly hundreds of thousands. I mean, and one of the examples that I talk about in the book is a town called Lewiston in Maine. And it was a town where the town manager that was dying. It was a typical mill town in New England. People had left and they couldn't get businesses to come because people were leaving. So there was no attraction for businesses to come. Yes. So the town manager said, gee, you know, they're immigrants trying to come to the United States. We should attract them. And he realized that this might be a problem because Maine is the whitest state in the country, and they were going to be attracting people from countries where they weren't white, including Somali refugees. and I'm going to make a very long story short, but the essay in the book and a book written by Heather McGee called The Sum of Us, extraordinary book, okay? She writes about this in depth. So the Somali immigrants come to town. They start to open businesses. The town starts to revive. They put lots of money in the coffers, but you got a very small number of people organizing against them. And a guy by the name of LePage, who sort of presaged Trump, really got on the wagon of anti-immigration. I mean, it was just off the rails. And an organization called the Maine People's Alliance organized and beat back the extremists. I mean, again, you had people coming together saying, no, we care about our town. We care about living in a town that's safe. We care about our education. We care about our environment. We need to work together on solving problems, not just screaming and yelling at one another. And so they got together and they passed legislation. They got things done. It was an amazing difference. So in addition to these stories, I want to just name a person who's extraordinary because she's on Instagram. Her name is Sharon McMahon. She's one of many people associated with an organization called Starts With Us, which I'll come back to in a second. But I'd like to do a shout out for Sharon McMahon because it's one of the easily accessible ways of beginning to break out of your own group. She has an Instagram site that has 1.1 million participants. She has workshops. She has book clubs. She has informational programs. She is just extraordinary. She started it a number of years ago because she was really annoyed as a someone who used to teach government and history when somebody got on the internet and started talking about the Electoral College in a completely distorted way. So she decided she was going to just put this little tiny thing up on her website or Instagram site, which she already had, and it went viral. Okay, it went totally viral. So she said, oh my God, there's a demand here. So she started doing these informational things. Eventually she ended up on Trevor Noah, you know, and it's an amazing, if you go look, Google Trevor Noah, Sharon McMahon, you'll see their interview. And she said, you know, I think people feel like they're getting played. They need a place they can go and get reliable facts, reliable information in a nonpartisan way where they can talk to people who have different views. So she had a workshop on abortion. And people completely, vastly different views got on this. And Elaine Godfrey at The Atlantic wrote an article about Sharon McMahon, highly recommend it. And she interviewed people about how they felt about the workshop. And they said, you know, it just totally opened my eyes. You know, I still am pro-life. I'm not pro-choice, but I can really understand the government should not tell a woman what to do with her body. Okay, that is not a choice government should make. And that's how she actually changed her view. Now, not everybody will, but they'll at least respect and understand the other side and have a reasoned, open debate about it.
Yeah.
So that's Sharon McMahon.
Yeah, let me just react to that for a second. And yeah. It really is about growing the 67% thing,
yes.
Like you talk about,
yes.
Like on this topic of abortion, for example. Yeah. If we can find that not taking an adversarial position, but trying to understand what for just a second appeals to this other side and we don't look
yes.
at it from the adversarial position. I'm just, you know, I'm thinking about the way we consume media, how we inoculate ourselves against falling prey to hate, to fear, you know, all these things and that initial reaction that we can have to when we consume media that makes us feel that kind of angsty,
yeah.
you know, the
yeah.
fear, the, you know, opposition. I feel like we can just start with a few of those little types of reactions to information.
I think that's really important. One of the think about there are two different models of the news. One is the dominant one, the other one's emerging, but it is emerging. The dominant one is the outrage model. And the one that's emerging is the engage model. It tries to engage people and engage their frontal lobes to think, okay, rather than just their amygdala to react. The reason we're so vulnerable to it is that we've been acculturated to have, well, two things. We've been acculturated to have an outrage mindset in ourselves. And so that makes us fearful. So we feel like we have to go get the news that's going to tell us about the next threat. And this is a self-reinforcing cycle between the outrage model of news and the outrage mindset. I think we would do well to reflect on our outrage mindset and try to shift to an engaged mindset where we say, maybe my fellow citizens are not adversaries. Maybe they share with me an interest in solving these common problems, even if we have different views on how to do it. Okay. Maybe if we put our heads together, we actually might invent something neither of us could imagine on our own. Okay. Right. Wow. You know, that's an engaged mindset. And so if we start to not just think about how can I understand the other person so I can persuade them better, but, you know, maybe there's something I'm missing that I need to really fully appreciate. Like I remember people under Biden near the end, he's still here, but you know, it's like they were saying, you know, Biden, you know, inflation on one side, and other people are saying, what do you mean? Inflation's better. Inflation's not a problem. The economy's great. The jobs are great. And what the people on who were saying that didn't see is that there were a lot of people, low-income people, who were having trouble buying food, who were having trouble buying gas, who were having trouble finding good housing. So to them, inflation was still a problem. So I think, you know, people who are on the liberal side need to see that. People who are on the, you know, on the more low-income side need to see that some of what we're going through are time delays. Okay, the lowering of inflation hasn't yet hit your community. That's not great solace, but meanwhile, jobs are getting created, wages are going up. These are things which will serve low-income communities. So, but people they're taking these either or adversarial positions, and they're not trying to engage a common problem. And if we shift that, I think we can make some progress.
Yeah. Diana, let me just ask you, you know, it's kind of easy for you in a way. It's like you're speaking to the choir. Like Mary Beth and I know that we shouldn't engage in outrage mindset. We should engage in engaged mindset. But I'd love to hear a story from you about someone who operates in the outrage mindset all the time and even goes down a deeper rabbit hole, and how maybe someone like that turned the corner, because we've got this percentage of people in the middle who are going to engage in engaged mindset and who are against the outrage mindset. But what about those people on the fringe? Can you?
You know, everybody always rivets on those folks. Okay. I don't think you need to. We need to move our country. We really do. I mean, this is serious. We're in a lot of trouble. We've got climate change happening very quickly. You actually don't need to persuade the 15 or 20% to make progress. And so I, if in my spare energy, I'm going, and by the way, I did this in organizations for 40 years and I moved organizations because I didn't try to persuade everybody on the fringes. Now, by the way, I think outliers and people on the fringes are like the canaries in the mine. You got to listen to them. You got to understand what they're concerned about. You need to address their worries, but persuade them, you really don't need to. Okay. We need to mobilize to 67% to solve problems that if we don't solve in the next few years, we're going to go down as a democracy and as a planet. So from a political strategic point of view, I'm happy to have conversations with those folks, but I don't need to persuade them. I would like them to persuade me. Okay. If anything, persuade me. Now, having said that, I go out of my way to make friends with people who are ideologically different from me and demographically different from me. And I have deep friendships with those folks, but we don't sit and make cases with each other. What we've tried to do is build relationships with each other, tear at the threads of those, but I'm not trying to persuade them. Does that make sense? Or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that actually makes me think of my next question was about, sometimes I think that there are many contributing factors I know that have brought us to where we are in the world right now, but not being heard. I think so many people feel that they're not heard, and that leads to this outrage mindset.
Absolutely.
And maybe it's attention spans have gotten a lot shorter. We're this headline society. If you have any thoughts on how can we listen better or make the people, even if they disagree from us, feel more heard.
Well, I mean, one of the things I always like to say is we need to not think, and liberals are so much a prey to this. I want people to feel hurt. Okay. No, I want them to be hurt. Okay. I want them to be hurt, not feel hurt. I mean, it's great if they feel hurt, but most important, they need to be hurt. So what does it take for you to hear somebody? First, you need to ask better questions. That's number one. Before you even listen, you need to say, tell me what you're worried about. What's on your mind? What makes you worry about that? What did you see? What did you hear? I was on a plane with a woman who was talking about how blacks were the reason why there was so much crime in Florida. Okay. And I said, well, tell me what, why you say that? You know, what is it that you're experiencing and seeing? She goes, every time I turn on the news, all I see are blacks rioting in the, okay. And I said, I can understand why you would think that given the news. You know, one of the things that I've been studying is how the news covers crime. And they tend to rivet on black crime more than white crime, disproportionate to the actual crime statistics. So that makes me worry about the perceptions we all have. What do you think about that? She said, well, I never thought about that before. And I said, well, no, and I hadn't either until I went and looked up the statistics, you know? But those are the kinds of conversations you can have with people.
And you know, when like more open-ended.
Yeah, more open-ended. And then, you know, but, you know, the, one of the essays in the book is How to Befriend Your Ideological Enemy, which is the most extreme case of a group of liberal college students building a relationship with a white, the heir apparent in the white nationalist movement, okay? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is possible, but they didn't try to make him feel heard. They actually listened to him. And then they got on a joint project to try to explore their different beliefs within light of data that they both considered valid, okay? I mean, that is just, that doesn't happen today. And, you know, it does happen. Obviously, it happened with them, but it needs to happen more often.
It's about looking at a situation, not from your own perspective, not from your own come from, but considering, trying to get to the other
person. Trying to understand theirs. Yeah. I like to say we need to see the world. We need to stand behind the other person's eyes and see the world they see.
Diana, I think we could talk to you all day, but maybe instead.
Sorry about that. But yeah.
Well, the book is Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. And we all know that we need to read a book like yours. So I'm
and
so happy
fun.
Yeah, it's just such an interesting conversation. Diana McLean Smith has been our guest. Diana, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
You're so welcome, and I hope to see you all in Utah soon.
I hope we see you on the slopes.
Yeah. That'd be great. All right. Take care.
Season. Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Well, coming up on August 24th and 25th is the climbing event of the year. It's the Salt Lake Climbing Festival. It takes place in the Uintas. It's produced by the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance, and lots of partners take a big role in the Salt Lake Climbing Festival. But joining us now in the studio to tell us more is, well, it seems like an annual interview we do with Julia Geisler of the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance, along with Cindy Grant of Inspired Summit Adventures. They're here to answer all of our climbing questions and get us excited about this event. So Julia and Cindy, welcome.
Thank you. What a beautiful morning in the mountains.
It sure is. You know, I always think of this. I know that there is a huge climbing presence in this area, but I think with all of our skiing and all of our mountain biking and all of these incredible recreation opportunities that we have here, those, some of them sort of take precedence over maybe something like climbing. But tell us, give us an overview of what a big climbing presence climbing has here.
Well, Utah, you know, you can climb year-round in Utah. You can only ski about 3 months of the year, maybe four if you're a backcountry skier like Cindy here. But you can climb everywhere in Utah, all the way from, you know, northern Utah all the way down to southern, and it's season-dependent. So right now, it's the Uintas season because you're up high when it's hot in the valley, especially in Salt Lake or in Park City. We go up high and we climb up high. There's all different rock types in Utah, so we are a world-class destination for climbing across the state.
And the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance, which you have been at the helm of for many years. How many years now?
13.
Wow. 13 years. Tell us about your mission.
Sure. So, well, my name is Julia Geisler. I'm executive director of the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance, and we are a local nonprofit climbing advocacy and stewardship organization. So what that means is we are keeping climbing areas open, mostly on public and some private land in Little Cottonwood. We work with the land agencies and private landowners to keep that access open for the public. We also maintain the resource. So the stewardship aspect of climbing areas is working on the parking and the trail leading up to the climbing area, as well as the fixed anchors, or we call them bolts, on the climbing wall itself. So we are out there maintaining that resource, keeping it well cared for so that climbers and the public can enjoy it.
Oh, that's wonderful that you have that those services for everybody. So in this festival that's coming up, is this something that only, you know, really experienced climbers are going to want to attend, or is it something that maybe people who are interested in climbing could also check out to explore?
You hit it on the nose. So this is a weekend event. It's a skills-based climbing festival, and it's a fundraiser for that work we do with advocacy and stewardship work of the nonprofit. And it is for everyone. So the reason we're having skills-based climbing clinics is you always have something to learn. And this is a safe environment to be able to come out to the festival and meet local guide outfitter services like Inspired Summit Adventures here today with me, and gain these skill sets from the professionals that can teach you the skills. These outfitters are giving back to the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance through this festival and donating their services and their clinics to raise money for the anchor and stewardship work.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm not sure I totally understand what an outfitter for climbing is about. Cindy Grant of Inspired Summit Adventures, could you explain it?
Absolutely. So we take people rock climbing, mountain biking, backcountry skiing, and you know, as Lynn said, skiing and biking are kind of like primary here in Park City, but rock climbing actually complements all of them really well. It's a lot of people think of it as like this big adrenaline sport, and when you do get up on a vertical wall, it kind of goes against all of your survival instincts, but that forces you to focus. And the cool thing, and why we like to support this festival and the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance in general, is because they're keeping it really safe. Rock climbing is actually one of the safer things you can do because you're tethered to the wall. So if you fall, you're just you're good to go. So it is an adrenaline sport, but it's also a mindfulness sport. And I think it goes really well with all the other things. So if you're just kind of mildly interested in climbing, our guides are, they basically have a college degree in rock climbing, in being in the mountains. They're certified AMGA, which is American Mountain Guide Association guides. So when you're going out with our guides, or you're going on one of these clinics, you're gonna learn all of the skills that they have spent years honing in, and you'll feel really safe, and you'll probably walk away with a lot more skills for yourself.
I always think rock climbing strikes me as like meditation and movement. You can't be thinking about a whole bunch of other things. You have to stay really focused in the now, and that's really appealing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were, before we came on air, we were all sort of comparing whether or not, or who had seen the climbing events in the Olympics. And I just saw a bit of the women's bouldering competition. And boy, Mary Beth, when you talk about mindfulness, you could see when there was a lapse of mindfulness, or when someone approached a problem too quickly. It was fascinating to watch, not only from that perspective, but just to see what these climbers can make their bodies do. As you watch the Olympics, with every new sport that you watch, you go, oh, that's the ultimate sport. They are the biggest athletes in the world. But I ended up thinking that after watching the climbing competition. So, Julia, you've been a climber for a long time, and you know, what most appeals to you about climbing?
Well, I think climbing is for everyone, especially as climbing gyms have popped up across the country and it's become more of a mainstream thing in our society. So any body type and, you know, any age can rock climb. I have friends that are in their 80s that are still climbing outdoors because the sport is lifelong. So if you can get into it, no matter what age you are, if you're 10 or if you're 50, it's a great sport to get into because it's lifelong and it's a way to get outdoors and appreciate nature and the landscapes that we have here in Utah. So yeah. That's what I most appreciate about it, is that it can be for anyone. It's super accessible, And this climbing festival is a great way to be introduced to this wonderful climbing community that we have. You don't have to know how to climb, or if you do know how to climb, you're going to learn something from these professional guides that are coming out and giving back. You know, Inspired Summit Adventures isn't the only outfitter that's teaching clinics, because there's a bunch of them. So we also have, White Pine Touring is here in Park City, and we have Utah Mountain Adventures. You might have heard of these companies. Mm-hmm. They're local businesses. Aspect Adventures, Backcountry Pros, Mountain Medical Academy, Wasatch Mountain Guides, Converge Physical Therapy, 12 Finger Adventure, and the Stone Project. So there are a bunch of outfitters, local businesses giving back for this event.
So not to mention, it's a huge party. So it's, again, August 24th and 25th. It's taking place about 35 miles east of Camas along the Mary Lake Highway at what has been known for many, many years as Camp Steiner. But that has recently been purchased. And how is that camp changing? I'm forgetting the name already.
Sunrock High Adventure Base just purchased Camp Steiner. It's been a Boy Scout camp for the last 100 years. And this property is magnificent. The views of the Mirror Lake, highway from Hayden Peak and Bald Mountain are really amazing at this camp. There's a lake there. It's really going to be the ultimate climber's camp out up there. It is camping, so there's not car camping. And it's just a way to be up in the mountains, and especially as these fall crisp colors are coming, bundling up and spending the evening with us. We
is
have
that
campfires.
Really happening? I know. Yes. I can't believe it already.
It's a wonderful camp. And the historical nature of it, the buildings on this property are from the 1940s, and they are beautiful to see. So
yeah. I love those. And will it be all nature-based? Like, are there just rock faces there, or will there be, those kind of portable things you see at festivals, or what's the actual physical setup?
Yes, so the beauty of this festival is that we are located right in the middle of the Mirror Lake Highway, and there are 100 crags, which are climbing areas along the Mirror Lake Highway, that we'll be taking the clinics to and spreading out at all the different climbing areas. So our home base is at Camp Steiner, Scout Lake, about 34 miles up the Mirror Lake Highway, like you said, across from Mirror Lake itself. But we are taking the clinics to all these rock climbing areas. They're outdoors. They're not manufactured walls. They're actually on rock clinics. Nice. Across the Mirror Lake Highway.
Oh, that's great. And is it something that you, if you want to come out and really just spend the weekend, settle in and enjoy it, do you make reservations ahead? Do you just show up? What's the best plan for people?
Well, we hope that you get your ticket in advance, saltlakeclimbingfestival.com. And what that gets you is two breakfasts, a dinner, camping, and then there's all kinds of things besides climbing clinics happening. We're taking people on a run with Hoka. We are having some of the historical people that have been up at the camp talk about the camp and its history, which is really fun around the campfire. We have a local band, Honky Blue Tonk. Honky Blue Tonky, coming out, sponsored by the Notch Pub.
Oh, the Notch is so good.
Friday night at the Notch, we're kind of gathering there to kick off the event, and then Saturday night is up at the camp. So it is Saturday and Sunday for the weekend, but you get food and camping and clinics and a party.
What's the cost for the tickets that you would purchase ahead?
There's a couple different options. If you want to do clinics, they're kind of add-ons, but the base is $65, and I don't know where you can get camping and three meals for $65 plus entertainment. And again, this is a fundraiser that goes back to the stewardship of Wasatch Climbing Areas.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Julia Geisler. She is the director of the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance, and also in the studio is Cindy Grant, the director of operations of one of the local guide outfitter businesses, Inspired Summit Adventures, that will be offering clinics up there. And what a good time. Cindy, I wanted to go back to something you were talking about climbing actually being pretty safe. And, I know you as a backcountry skier and a mountain biker, and you live large. Is climbing the safest sport of many of these sports that we practice here, if you're doing it correctly, if you're not making a mistake?
Yeah, I think so. I'm also a mother of two, so I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old.
That's actually the most dangerous.
Yeah, I take them rock climbing, so I'd say it's very safe. It's safer than skiing or mountain biking, because skiing and mountain biking are high velocity sports versus rock climbing, you're a little bit more, it's like what Mary Beth said, it's mindful. You're on the rock, you're in the moment, you're presently there, and you're tied into a harness, which is tied in. We always have redundancy in climbing, so we're going to have backup plans for safety. And everything, if plan A went wrong, plan B would be there to catch you. It's it's a very safe sport that if you were to fall, feels really intimidating the first time, but we've got you on the rope.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the work that the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance does, when you talk about securing bolts and going through all of the bolts that are on the 100 crags and, you know, just up the Mirror Lake Highway itself, this is a lot of work. And then easements and, you know, maintaining trailheads. What kind of budget are you looking at? Obviously, this is a fundraiser. So what kind of funds are you looking to raise?
Well, that's a great question. So this does support our year-round programming for the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance. And just to give you an idea, we have the first and only professional anchor maintenance crew in the nation here, meaning we employ five people to go out and be maintaining anchors here in the Wasatch. And that means they have the kits, you know, the safety gear. We're putting in stainless steel hardware, and there are thousands of bolts across the Wasatch, you know, not only in the Uintas, but we're in Little and Big Cottonwood, American Fork, Maple Canyon. And so we're maintaining this resource. Can we do it all? No. but we're out there doing that. So that program alone costs us about $100,000 a year. And then you add on top of that, you know, trail projects. And those vary depending on how much footage you're trying to do with a trail, and then you have your advocacy efforts and whatnot. But just that program alone is about $100,000 a year. So any little bit helps, and these tickets go back into that. The sponsors coming out for this are all your outdoor industry partners. They're giving back, and it really is a communal effort to be able to raise these funds so that we can maintain this resource that we're all using, from the outfitters to the equipment that's being used out there with Black Diamond and Petzl and the other outdoor companies.
Wow. Is there a way to know if you're a climber, what routes have been recently checked over or anything like that?
Great question. Yes. At our website, saltlakeclimbers.org, we have different landing pages for the different programs we do. And on one of those is anchor maintenance. And you can see the list of things that we've been working on throughout the years. A couple of the folks on our crew live here locally, Alex Lemieux and Eric Salmi. They're also guides. They'll be at the climbing festival. So, and the others are in Salt Lake. So the crew are really professionals in this type of work
oh, wow.
at height.
What other kinds of things could we find at saltlakeclimbing.com?
Sure. So saltlakeclimbingfestival.com is where you get your festival tickets. And then the Climbers Alliance webpage is saltlakeclimbers.org.
Oh.
Both link to each other, but you can see all the work that we do to keep climbing areas open and well cared for.
Yeah. I'm wondering about easements and trailheads and things like that. Is it getting more difficult? I mean, I remember so long ago in Park City when someone talked about having a trail near their house. People were like, no, are you kidding? And then it became almost like, you know, it added to your property value if you had a trail coming by your house. And those things change. They kind of go in cycles a little bit. What about access to climbing areas? Is it harder to get an easement to maintain a trailhead? Are you constantly looking for new ones?
Great question. So in the Wasatch, most of the property that climbing exists on is on Forest Service land, so the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest or the Manti La Salle National Forest. So that kind of advocacy work is working with the Forest Service to make sure that there are policies in place and that maintenance is being paid attention to for this climbing resource. And that's a lot of work. We come to the table as, you know, professional trail crews and professional anchor maintenance crews working with the Forest Service to get that work done. The Salt Lake Climbers Alliance also holds a lease for the Gate Buttress property, which is in Little Cottonwood Canyon, and that is owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's 140 acres at the bottom of Little Cottonwood, and that's a relationship that's different than the Forest Service, but very much the same, where we're out there making sure that the land agency or the landowner is happy with what's happening on the property with climbing and that the resource is being well cared for and people are educated about how to use it, you know, as best they can with the ethics and the leave no trace principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cindy, you're the director of operations for Inspired Summit Adventures. And as far as I know, this is a very popular guiding business here. You know, people who have been around Park City for quite a long time and a really great just kind of feel about the stuff that you do. But tell us a little bit more about the business. And I mean,
you're volunteering these services for the Salt Lake Climbing Festival, so.
Absolutely. So we are a year-round guide service. We're most popularly known for our backcountry skiing trips. We take people out to the Uintas in particular on snowmobile access backcountry ski trips. So we'll snowmobile, put our skins on, climb up, ski down. We also own the Castle Peak Yurt, which is right up Upper Setting Road off the Mirror Lake Highway. It's at the very top of the Slate Creek Trail System, so it's a great yurt for mountain biking as well. And we also have climbing right outside of the yurt, too. So the Castle Peak is there, and then Castle Lake is there. So we do stand-up paddleboarding and fishing and all kinds of stuff. but we're in the summer, we do mountain biking, rock climbing, hiking, and we love doing trips out of the yurt. And we do a lot of retreat stuff too. So it's kind of a jack of all trades of all outdoor things. But our custom retreats are really cool. We can make basically the coolest party, outdoor party you could ever dream of, and turn it into a multi-day event.
I always wonder for when you're doing an outfitter adventure, if people are of different levels. You know, there's always some in Park City, there's bound to be some like world-class mountain biker next to you and you're a novice. So how do you balance that out, or do you kind of organize it by skill level?
Absolutely. So all of our trips are custom. So we build it around our clients and we're going to cater it to their ability levels. So you come to us and we meet you where you're at and we take you where you want to go. And so we try to make your goals our goals and help you get there.
Oh, that's wonderful. And is there much of a community in Utah for climbers, or is it more something that people take on just on their own or with a friend?
Oh, it's an awesome community. The cool thing about rock climbing is it fosters community, because you can't just go out on a mountain bike ride by yourself like you could, or on a climbing trip by yourself. You need to have partners. So you're belaying each other. There's a lot of knowledge about where to go. It kind of comes together as a community. And then these festivals are a perfect way to meet people. So the Salt Lake Climbers Festival is a great way to meet partners if you want to, you know, have people to go out and go rock climbing with. And then if it's something that feels like you'd like some instruction, our guided climbs are so much fun and you're really well taken care of. And like I said, it's going to be customized to your ability.
Oh, that just makes me think it's such a great balance. It's much like the mindfulness and excitement, kind of partnership and independence. I bet you have a lot of self-reliance, but you also learn to trust the people that you're working with. That sounds great.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you can, you know, you can take your skills and keep growing and growing and growing. And in this town, you know, there's an infinite amount of possibilities.
No limit. Yeah.
The festival is a great glimpse at all the outfitters and what they offer, so that you can do things with them year round, like Cindy's talking about with the backcountry ski trips. You know, you get to meet these local businesses and then you can support them and come out again with them. This is just a small glimpse of what they all do.
Do you have a cap on the numbers that you can accommodate for the festival, or do you ever reach that? What are the numbers looking like?
Thanks for asking. So yes, there are only so many climbing areas that we can take people to, and there are only so many climbing guides available. So we do have a cap. This will sell out. So SaltLakeClimbingFestival.com again for those tickets, August 24th and 25th. We accommodate about 100, 150 people for actual climbing clinics. And then up at the camp, you know, the festivities. We have a huge vendor village and live music. And, oh, I forgot, there is yoga. There is swimming and running and all these clinics that are going on. It's not just climbing.
It sounds like a ball.
We'll see you there.
Yeah, I'm interested.
I think this is your chance, Mary Beth.
I know. I'm maybe this is my moment. I'm tall.
Yeah,
maybe right. That'll be good for me.
I love it. Okay, so again, it's not this weekend, but the next weekend. You need to get your tickets soon because it does sell out. It kicks off on Friday night at the Notch, which is, you know, what a great establishment that is, on the Mary Lake Highway down low, just east of Camas. And then the festival is Saturday and Sunday. It's all day, both days?
All day. We're inviting you to camp out with us. You know, you bring your tent and all your warm layers, because as you know, getting up to 10,000 feet, you come from Salt Lake City, it's at least 20 degrees colder. It can snow, it has snowed. That's not going to happen to us. We'll have campfires, but you know, it is full camping, so your headlamps, securing your food from bears that are active up there right now, and things like that. But we help guide you along that path of camping as well. So thanks for the opportunity, and we hope to see you all out in the mountains with us.
$65 will get you in. It pays for camping and some meals. And then the clinics aside, just quickly, how much are the clinics?
There are different ones. So we have ground schools that are about 2 hours long, and those are an additional $55. And then we have on-rock clinics, and I can't remember the exact price for those, but they are on the website, saltlakeclimbingfestival.com. It depends if you're going out full day or for a ground school clinic. And ground school clinics are the skills condensed down into 2 hours.
And that $65 gets you also some great music.
Honky Tonk Blues.
Honky Tonk Blues.
Local canvas band.
Nice. There we go. Lots of fun. Well, Julia Geisler is the director of the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance, and Cindy Grant is here as a representative of Inspired Summit Adventures, one of the outfitters that will be there, one of many, it sounds like. Cindy and Julia, great to see you both, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Rock on.
Thank you so much.